Oh, when you park your car, the engine's hot. It takes a while to cool down. So this is just the body trying to get rid of excess energy as you make the transition from being very busy and active to actually to being still. Quite natural. Dear Ajahn, what is the energy of a place? How good energy grows? How bad energy grows? Why one can't bear if there's too much good energy? A lot of time is because the more good energy, when it's very strong, you're out of control. You can't control it. And that's why people get scared. It's all this control freak business. You always think that you're in charge, but let go and enjoy this brilliant energy. You can't do it. There's one couple, Barbara and Ainsley. This is a really good story. Actually, you wouldn't mind me telling you who it was, but this is this English lady, you know, married to an Anglo-Indian. And you know, she was a Christian before, but her husband became a Buddhist, and so you know, he dragged her along. Now she's a really good Buddhist. And she was, we went on a pilgrimage to India to see the Buddhist holy sites. And so before we went, you know, we did a little bit of orientation, telling her what to expect and what to do. And I gave a little speech, and part of my speech was, some places have really strong energy. And I want to warn you about that. Some places, you know, these are places where the Buddha lived, where he got enlightened. This is huge energy, and sometimes you just burst out crying. You know, as I do, always in Rajagaha and Vulture Speak, I can't stop myself. It's just so much energy there. It's beautiful. And she told me afterwards that when I said that, she thought I was loopy. Because she was English, okay? She'd been to castles and old palaces. There's heaps and heaps of ruins in the country of England. This is just another ruin, another architectural site, that's all. You know, bunch of old bricks. So she thought I was stupid. But when we landed in Gaya, you know, there's an airport there now. First night, went into the Mahabodhi Temple. You know, that's you know, where the Buddha became enlightened. And as soon as she walked in, she started weeping uncontrollably, totally unexpected. So she came to ask forgiveness and said, I'm sorry, Ajahn Brahm, but you were right. And that was a wonderful story because you know, she was a prim and proper English woman and you know, she couldn't help herself. The energy just got her, even though she was warned. And this is it, some places do have energy, really good energy. The bad energy, the worst place I've been for bad energy, again going on a pilgrimage, I went into the, then they took us on this tour of Kathmandu. I wasn't interested in those tours of Kathmandu, but I went along, getting bored. And one of the palaces is a little courtyard. I was bored with what the guide was saying, so being a naughty monk, I just wandered off and went through this courtyard. And through this arched door, and inside it, just really bad energy. And I was just repelled. You know, you could feel, I didn't know what the heck I was doing in this place or what it was. It was really evil energy. And when I went out very quickly and asked the guard, I said, what is it, that place? I said, that's the place in Kathmandu when they still had the kings, where they do the annual slaughter of animals according to the Hindu custom. You know, they kill all these animals ritually there every year. And I didn't know that, but you certainly felt the energy. It was a really bad stuff place. So, you know, places do have energy, and you don't need to be an enlightened monk or even sensitive. You know, everybody can feel. Some places feel really good. Some places are really, really stuff. You want to get out as soon as possible. So there are places with energy, but these places here have got great energy. Now, Jhana Grove. You know, how long have we been here now? 3 years? 4 years? 4 years. It's building up its energy. It feels peaceful. It feels good. So no, we're getting there. Bodhinyana has been 30 years there, so that's really a good place. You mentioned the Zen method of meditation, watching the wall. Could we try that as well when we are bored with watching the inside of our eyelids? And what are we supposed to do if the wall disappears? Yeah, you can do that if you like. You know, watch a wall. But the point is, to be able to get the wall to disappear, your mind has to be pretty still, no thoughts. Because a lot of time you may be watching the wall, you know, with about 10% of your brain, and thinking about dinner and remembering all the past and remembering your favorite movie or whatever it was, fantasizing and dreaming. And if your mind isn't still, of course the wall doesn't disappear because, you know, you're paying more attention to the brain or the mental world. So you have to be pretty still in your mind and just watch the wall, and then it vanishes. Weird thing to do. So yeah, you can try that just for something to do. It's much better to watch your body and watch that disappear. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in chapter 1 of The Art of Disappearing, I mean somebody's actually read that. You mentioned that accepting is different from disengaging. Could you please explain the difference? Thank you. Oh my goodness, what did I mean? I haven't got a clue what I meant. I did that a long time ago. You don't expect me to remember what I said. I don't even understand what it means. What is it? Accepting is different from disengaging. No, I don't know. I'll leave that for another time. You can show me in the book and I'll have a look, see what I meant. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can one train oneself not to judge other people? Much would be better. If you do judge other people, don't worry about it. Don't judge yourself for judging others. So in other words, how on earth can you judge other people? What do you know about other people? If you can read their minds, if you know all their history, if you know exactly why they did what they did, then maybe you can judge somebody else. A lot of times we've only got incomplete information. And because we haven't got the full story, we jump to conclusions. And that shows you we shouldn't judge others. A long time ago I told this story to a packed audience in Dhammaloka Temple. It was a time when there was many monks from Thailand were caught with mistresses, breaking their precepts. And so I thought this was a good time to make my own confession in front of everybody. I said with perfect honesty, I wasn't making this up. I said some years previously, I spent some of the happiest moments in my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other. And that woman had a husband. When I said that, people were shocked. They judged me. They said, oh no, not Ajahn Brahm as well. And then I told them, that woman was my mother. It was true. I spent some of the happiest moments of my life when I was young in the loving arms of my mother, who was another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged. When I explained, I thought, oh yeah, that's okay. Because I said it specifically. It was absolutely true. But what people thought, that's adultery. You know, you're going off, not only just with as a monk, as if a lay person in the loving arms of another man's wife, that's adultery. But it wasn't, because it was my mother. That's okay. So I did that on purpose to say how easy it is to judge somebody without the facts and come to a totally wrong conclusion. Have you ever been judged wrongly? Accused of things you never did? Put your hand up if that's never happened to you. Really? Well, it's happened to me many times. Judged for things you didn't do. But that's the world. Even the Buddha was judged for things he didn't do. So when you realize that, it's just not worth judging other people. Or if you do judge them, give them the benefit of the doubt. Always give them the benefit of the doubt. If your husband comes home late from work, give him the benefit of the doubt that he's been working overtime. Don't judge him and say, that must be a woman. Or that story about Ajahn Yanadamo years ago. We went to meet him at the airport. And he smelt like a distillery, whiskey smell all over him. I said, what the heck have you been doing? And his story was, he was flying from Adelaide back to Perth, and he was sitting next to a man who was terrified of flying, who said the only way he could cope, you know, with the anxiety of being up in the air, was drinking glass after glass of whiskey, which was free on the aircraft. So he drank so much whiskey, and as they were coming into land on Perth Airport, there was turbulence. And because of the turbulence, he spilled his full glass of whiskey all over this monk's robe. And so when he came out, he was actually smelling all over of whiskey. That was his explanation. We gave him the benefit of the doubt. That's much nicer than judging people. So always, if you are judging, they're innocent until they're absolutely proved guilty. Why is it, especially during the retreat, I woke up with unusual realization in the body-like vibration at the heart, navel, etc. Grows became stronger at the end of the retreat. During the retreat, I wake up with unusual something, realization in the body like vibration at the heart, navel, etc. I don't know what's going on there, but if it's nice, if it's peaceful, fine. Whatever you experience, just be aware and be kind to it. Don't ever get excited, don't ever get afraid, just relax. It must be something to do with your body, usually some sort of healing happening. Any sort of weird stuff going on in the body, if you're being very peaceful and relaxing, letting go, any weird stuff is usually some balancing of the energies of the body, just some healing going on. So if it's happening, great. My mind seems to be like a hard task master in my daily life. And here too, I wake up and immediately my mind is like a harsh boss that says, you better do this, you better do that, without any real negotiation. With me, it is, if that makes sense, it is almost like I'm never off the hook. Any help to soften that boss for us would be much appreciated. Thank you. Ah, you poor thing. Who's the boss in this retreat center? I am the boss. So I tell your boss. To let go. Give yourself a break. Don't be so hard on yourself. So you go to the big boss. And big boss says, let go, be kind, and be mindful. So when the big boss says one thing, you remember, now when your boss says one thing, remember what the big boss says. Okay? So I countermand your boss by saying, let go, relax. Have a wonderful day and don't do anything. See if you can be a total failure today and actually achieve absolutely nothing. Because achieving nothing is an amazing thing, to realize nothing, the great emptiness when nothing is there. They always, some Christian friends of mine actually said that nothing is higher than God. I said, exactly. Emptiness is far superior than any God. I agree with you. Nothing is better than God. So see if you can achieve nothing. And today, do nothing, the very highest.
Okay, so that's your answer. That's sort of. I'm getting away with these.
A monk has suggested a use of the singing bowl, the one you use at the end of the meditation, in meditation. He said to listen to it until we can separate the sound from the hearing. Could you please explain that? Will you encourage this method? Three lowest bows. Ah, oh, come on. It's too much sound goes on. Instead of using the singing bowl, use the rustling meditator, or the burping, the snoring, the coughing meditator, until you can separate the sound of the person disturbing you from the hearing. That's much more useful than using the singing bowl. Is it really silent in here all the time, or are people still making noise? In your cottage, is there one person who always bangs the doors and always gets up really early when you're trying to sleep and boils the kettle? And when they got the spoon and to make their coffee. Have you got one of those in your room? Use those as the singing bowl. And see if you can separate the hearing from the noise. So, you have enough singing bowls. So, in just your life. So, no need to do this singing bowl here. When I meditate, I recall all the bad things I did to others in the past. How can I forget and forgive them? You need to do penance. If you have done all those bad things in the past, you recall them, you need punishment. So you know what I said, the punishment of 50 strokes of... I told the 50 strokes of the cat story, didn't I? Yeah, I did. 50 strokes. We haven't got a cat here, but we have got a rabbit. A really fluffy rabbit. So if you want to do a penance, all the bad things you have done in the past, I sentence the author of this question to 50 strokes of the rabbit. So you can ask Dania to borrow the rabbit and hold it and stroke it 50 times. If that doesn't work, I'll give you another 50 strokes. 100 strokes of the rabbit. Because when you're stroking a fluffy little animal, especially one which is alive rather than a teddy bear who's in jhana, the best thing which happens is that you feel compassion and kindness. When you feel compassion and kindness to a little fluffy animal, there's a good chance you can transfer that compassion and kindness to yourself and forgive and let go. Yeah, you've done all the bad things in the past, but that's not much. You know, even the Buddha could forgive Angulimala, who almost killed his mother and killed 999 people. The Buddha can forgive that guy, serial killer, and that killer could get enlightened, fully enlightened, an arahant. So if it's possible for them, it must be possible for you, unless actually there's any serial killers here. Any serial killers here, you better tell us so we can all lock our doors tonight. So you let them go through kindness. Be kind to yourself. Thank you for your great advice and guidance during this retreat. Yes, it was great advice and good guidance. Thank you so much. Do I have to read the rest of the question? That's good. If someone praises you, receive it, so encourage more. I have a question about bad karma. I truly believe that with negativity you attract negative things, bad karma, into your life. However, it confuses me why the wise, wonderful Ajahn Chah had to suffer physically with his illness at the end of his life, or why the great terror Moggallana in Buddhist days had to die in such unfortunate circumstances, bashed to death. Some insights of this would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. With metta, sometimes it's very strong karma. You know, it's physical stuff which, you know, you can't avoid. But what you can do with the bad karma which comes from time to time is your attitude towards it. Just let it be. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with whatever you are experiencing. As I said this evening several times already, it doesn't matter what the object of your mind is, the cause of real suffering or freedom is your attitude. Are you trying to get rid of things? Are you upset? Are you frustrated? Trying to get somewhere else? Are you at peace? And you know, even with pain, it's a weird thing, but I've done this, and many other people have done this, in really strong pain, if you let it be, you don't try and get rid of it. You know, you accept it. Your attitude towards agony, it's just this wonderful opening the door of your heart to what you're feeling. Welcoming it. The pain vanishes. It's what the Buddha actually said. There's two parts to pain. The physical part and the mental part. And the physical part is just tiny compared to the mental anguish. And if you can let go of the mental anguish, the physical part is very easy to endure. That is why the torturers, physical stuff, they know that people can endure. It's the mental stuff. You know, that it's going to hurt. You're going to wish you were never born. You know, I'm going to show you all this. This is going to really hurt. I'm going to show you it first of all. It's that sort of anticipation. It's the mental anguish, which is really sort of the worst form of torture. Physical pain is not that bad. Just like all of you have given birth. You've given birth. If someone comes along and says, oh yeah, I had a kid, it really hurt. Oh, I was in agony for days. Oh, it was terrible. What does that do for you? I don't want to have a kid ever. It's not like that. I remember reading this book, which we had in our monastery in Thailand. Really weird. We had a book about how to give birth to babies. So the reason we had it had some really good sort of, you know, good advice. One of the things it said, don't even call it labour pain. When you call it labour pain, straight away the idea comes into your mind, this is going to hurt. So in this little community, they said they always called it labour energy. Energy, not pain. And just that just change of word, change attitude. So people, they felt this great energy rush, you know, during the contractions of labour. And number one, they said, you know, the women who went through this process, you know, they gave birth really quickly. They said it didn't hurt. It was just energy going through. The psychological part of pain is huge. And if you can just change the psychology, it's really quite easy. So, it's a shame I'm a monk, because I've been very good at giving birth. Can you please explain about the relationship to eating meat and karma? I could choose not to eat meat. I don't kill animals. I directly order killing to produce food. I like the taste of meat, plus it's cultural and easy with metta. If you can be a vegetarian, fine. Not all people can be a vegetarian. But if you are a vegetarian, don't judge people who are not vegetarians. So you just do the very best you can. Because I know a lot of... I remember when I was a vegetarian, when you become a monk, I was told I couldn't be a vegetarian. I had to eat whatever I was given. And you all know the stories of eating frogs and snails. I'd give anything to have some vegetarian food in those early days. But I do remember once going to see my girlfriend, and she was going to cook me a dinner. And she forgot that I was vegetarian. It just slipped her mind. So she made this meal for me, and I refused to eat it. And imagine, you go out, and someone's cooked, you've gone to all that trouble to try and get you a meal, make it delicious, and you refuse to eat any of it because it's got meat in it. And that was the end of that relationship. But after, I look back upon that, and just, oh, what a bad thing that was to do. And I look back upon that, and I think, you know, I was the one who was wrong there. Yeah, I loved animals, but I hated people. I was really cruel to her. And I'm not proud of that at all. I admit that I made a big mistake there. I should have just eaten the meal, said thank you, said, look, next time, please make it vegetarian. That would have been the appropriate thing to do. Instead of being sort of like a vegetarian terrorist. So, if you can, fine. But don't be a terrorist. Could you please explain the relevance of the chanting to the practice of meditation? Or is it more like prayer? What about when it is in a language I do not understand, especially since I cannot read the English on the opposite page at the same time? The advantage of chanting in a language you can't understand is that as a monk I can make mistakes without being caught. It's true, because this did happen once. I confessed it. I won't say to whom, but I was doing a marriage ceremony. You know, I do lots of marriage ceremonies. I mean, I'm really tired sometimes. You know, go overseas and you come back late and you don't get enough sleep and you jet lagged. So, you know, just by mistake I did the funeral chants instead of the marriage chants. And no one knew. They said, oh, beautiful chanting, thank you so much. And they're still together, so it didn't really matter. So that's one of the advantages. The monks chant in the language no one understands. But you know, these days sometimes, you know, people have been monks before, or they know some party chanting, and I've got to really be on my toes then, because they catch me out sometimes. Because I know parties, some of the chants we do are really inspiring. So I really get off on some of the chants which we do. But you know, we try and translate some into English, like the Metta Sutta, which again is very, very nice. You know, but you know, as I said the other night, you know, just it's very, very demeaning to the female Sangha. Whatever living beings they may be, omitting nuns, the great or the mighty. That's what it said, omitting none. Yes. So, but when you actually read it properly, it's fine. So that's the reason we do the chanting. Dear Ajahn, does the Eightfold Path appear in the order of importance? Ah, that's a good question. Actually, I would say yes. Most of it is, you know, it's all over the place, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But when you really get into that Eightfold Path, the first thing which is fulfilled, you know, is the right view. And from that you get, I'll talk about right intention tomorrow because it's really important. And then that leads to the eighth factor, which is, you know, the final part of the path, jhanas, samadhi. And there you have that in the Anguttara, that one leads to the other. And as a result of that, you see things as they truly are. You get the wisdom. And from that, you get the enlightenment. So yeah, it is a sequential thing. But at first, it's all over the place. But when you really get it together, it actually works, and samadhi is the pinnacle. And from that of the path, and from that the result is the insights. That's in the Anguttara Nikaya. Dear Ajahn, please explain the meaning of Sammaditti and Sammasankappa. Okay, Sammasankappa is going to come tomorrow. Sammaditti will come in a few days' time, when we do about insight. Dear Ajahn, I'm wondering why we have to eat only vegetarian food on this retreat. Because we only cook vegetarian food, that's why you have to eat it. If we cook meat food, then you could eat meat. So somebody once said, even if you eat cow, cow is only processed grass. That's what someone told me the other day. It's vegetarian, it's processed grass. That's what a cow is. But no, it's... we decided a long time ago to try and make this a vegetarian retreat, even though that sometimes it might be tough. It's only for you guys 9 days. You know, when you have the 9 days, if you really want some meat, you can go outside and get a burger. But if I find the pizza home delivery guy arriving at midnight, because one of you have called in for a pizza, then you'll be in big trouble if you don't give some to me. In the morning, when it's allowable. Dear Ajahn, can you explain how ego self affect meditation? Skillful way to manage it. Yeah, the ego self is always controlling. What the Buddha said is when there's a me, then there's a mine. So whenever you have a sense of ego and self, you have this area which you control. Your possession, your mind. Just like, you know, sometimes you may think you own your room. So you want to control it to keep all the sound out. You know, that's your nest already. So it doesn't belong to you. You're only there for a certain time. So when there's a self, there's a sense of control. So I've just been telling people that... I just wrote this little story for the book recently. That when... I don't know if I told a story here. I keep telling many stories. I don't know where I told them. But when I... for many years, I was working so hard. On the weekend, I'd go to Nolamara to teach, and then 5 days teaching at Bodhinyana, or administrating, building, working. And then you go overseas. It's just always 7 days a week, work, 24 hours a day. And sometimes visitors would come to the monastery over the road, like you visited, say, it's a beautiful monastery. It's so peaceful and so tranquil. And I'd say, are you crazy? This is where I work. It's so busy. There's so much building and maintenance to do. There's all these telephone calls to answer and all these stupid questions which people give you to answer. And I've got to train the monks. Oh, it's just, what do you mean a tranquil place? This is my work camp. And I realized something was very wrong. And so how could I rest in the monastery where I was the abbot? And the only way I could do that, and a very powerful way, was once a week in the mornings, I would imagine I was a visitor, not an owner. I'd pretend I was just like you, just coming for the morning, just visiting. And when I was a visitor, I didn't need to answer all those questions. I'm a visiting, it's somebody else's problem. I didn't need to do all the building and maintenance. I didn't need to do anything. I'm a visitor. When I was a visitor, I could enjoy the place. When I was an owner, I had too many responsibilities. And I teach that to everybody else. When you go home, one morning a week, or maybe in the weekend, imagine you're a visitor to the home in which you live. And if you're a visitor, when you visit somebody else's house, do you wash the dishes for them? Do you vacuum the carpet and mow the lawn? Of course you don't. That's not your house. It's somebody else's problem. You just go in there, have a cup of coffee, talk, enjoy everything, and then you leave and let somebody else do the work because you're a visitor. So imagine, pretend you're a visitor in the house in which you live, and then you can relax and enjoy it. If you're an owner, you have to control. If you're a visitor, you can let go. So be a visitor to this meditation retreat. You just let go and enjoy it. Be a visitor to your meditation cushion. Be a visitor to your body, a visitor to your mind. Then you can let it go. It's not your problem anymore. Mine, you can do whatever you want. Not mine. I don't control you anymore. I don't own you. That's what the Buddha said. Not me, not mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to me. Here you go. If you want to think, that's fine by me. Whatever you want. Body, you want to get sick. You want to get sleep. You want to do whatever. Fine by me. I don't own you. I'm a visitor, not an owner. Whenever you have an ego, you're a big owner. You want to control everything. And tell Dania how to caretake this place. Dania, this is what you do. Don't do it this way, do it that way. You can't say that you're a visitor, not an owner. So that's how you can let go in meditation. Be a visitor to this moment, not an owner. Time to time I experience a fleeting feeling of dissatisfaction in my mind. What could be the cause? What is the skillful way to manage it? Only a fleeting feeling? If it's a fleeting feeling, it goes by itself. So be satisfied. Your dissatisfaction is fleeting. In other words, if that's the case, you've got fleeting dissatisfaction. Just the way your mind is now, let it go. If it's only a short bit of dissatisfaction, that's wonderful. The two bad bricks in the wall make the wall beautiful. So a little bit of dissatisfaction in your life means that the rest of the time when you're satisfied, you can really appreciate it. If you were satisfied all the time, you'd take it for granted. Just like they used to say in Christian theology, if you go to heaven, one day a year you have to go to hell, just on a holiday, so you can appreciate heaven. Otherwise, you'll take it for granted. So it's good to go to hell one day a year when you go to heaven, just so you can appreciate what it's like in heaven. There's actually a very powerful little philosophy there. So a little bit of dissatisfaction in your life makes you appreciate peace. Last question. This is the first question. Can by watching stillness we get into jhana instead of breath? I already answered that. It's amazing. You always come back to where you started. That is the circle of life. So I managed to answer all these questions except that question about my book, which I can't remember. So I don't care. It's nice actually when you lose your memory. When you lose your memory, you've got nothing to worry about. So it's really looking forward to dementia. It's only just that bit away from enlightenment, is it? I don't know. At least you can let go of the past. So there's all the questions for tonight. I hope you enjoyed them. Some were funny. Some were actually quite serious. I gave a few similes on the way. Whenever I give a talk, I like to ask people afterwards, what did I talk about? It was good. But I don't quite remember, except for the jokes. But you don't have to be concerned about trying to remember all this huge amount of information about meditation or Dhamma that I'm giving here. There are 2 hours a day, or even more than that, with the interviews. It's a huge amount of information I'm putting into your heads. You don't have to try and retain it, because what happens, it goes into your head anyway. It gets stored in there somewhere, because I remember that's what happened with Ajahn Chah. He would talk a lot. A lot of it I thought I never remembered until years later you'd be meditating and a problem came up and you remembered the solution which Ajahn Chah said. It was stored there somewhere, only it wasn't relevant now, so it wasn't in the front of your mind. All these little things I've said, they actually do come up at the right time and the right place when it's important for you. So don't try to remember it. it comes up. And it's amazing to see that. Ah, Ajahn Brahm said that years ago. Now it's relevant. So that's actually why I don't mind teaching at length. So there we go. Another night of questions and entertainment. So now, those of you who've got energy, you can meditate more. And if you get enlightened tonight, then you can leave tomorrow morning and you can have your hamburgers and meat, whatever you like. But if you don't get enlightened tonight, you have to stay for a few more days. So, those of you who want the fast track, no, just be kind to yourself. That's the fast track. Be kind, make peace, be gentle. Sadhu. Sadhu. Be patient. Sadhu. Never do it the same. Do it different every time. Very good. So have a nice night. See you all in the morning. Maybe. Those who don't get eaten by the, was it the Holman? The Holman and the handuk.
Very good.